Get off my world.
Get off my world.
Get off my world.
I'm Pat.
I'm Josh.
And I'm Kelvin.
And this is Get Off My World. We're three guys and the occasional guest who love the classic Doctor Who series and try our best to love the new series too. We're going to take you through five rounds, rapid, and get to the bottom of what's great and what's not so great about our favorite show. And this episode and the next episode, we're going to be joined by two very special guests. Minneapolis actor and comedian Tim Uren.
Hello!
And role-playing game legend, Scott Glancy.
Legend? Really? You went with legend? Okay, fine. Yeah, I'm here.
Thanks, guys.
Role-playing paragon?
Raconteur.
So,
Gadfly. Moving along.
We're going to kick off the podcast with round one, Temporal Grace, in which we're going to say something that makes us happy about the world of Doctor Who. And as our guests, why don't we start with Tim and Scott in that order.
All right. I recently went to go see, with my wife, Mad Max, which is not my temporal grace. but it had a trailer for Guillermo del Toro's upcoming film, Crimson Peak. And I was delighted, and I thought, how can I possibly relate this to Doctor Who for this particular round? Turns out, Gorman, the dude from Torchwood.
Bern Gorman?
Bern Gorman.
He was on Game of Thrones, too.
Also in Game of Thrones, in Crimson Peak, in Torchwood. Totally counts. I'm excited about that movie, Crimson Peak.
Excellent.
Wow, that was a stretch. I didn't realize that was an option for temporal grace.
We didn't either, but that's cool.
Are you going to dial in closer, Scott?
Yes, I am. Having gone back and watched the old shows, I think my moment of temporal grace is that no matter how terrible the current scripts are, they can't go back like Lucas and screw up the scripts that they got right the first time. So that would be my. That's how I can feel good about Doctor Who, is that at least when they get it right, they can't go back and ruin it.
Well, I enjoy when you can make your happy thing a really negative thing. That's a virtue in my book.
Are you going to do that, Josh?
No, actually, I have something really nice to say. I recently read Engines of War by George Mann, and this is the first BBC-licensed War Doctor story outside of The Day of the Doctor. And it is actually great fun. In a lot of ways, it's kind of a prequel to Day of the Doctor, and it is also kind of weirdly a sequel to The Five Doctors. So if you're that kind of geek who would like to see John Hurt and Timothy Dalton in the council chambers from The Five Doctors with the harp and everything, then this is the book for you. They also kind of canonically make Genesis of the Daleks the first event of the Time War, which is kind of, again, geeky fun. There is also what I believe to be a nod, weirdly enough, to Sam, a companion of the Eighth Doctor in the BBC book. So there's all sorts of little weird Easter eggs in it, and the prose is actually pretty good. It's kind of like a young adult Terrence Dix sort of mashup with Hunger Games, Suzanne Collins with the Time War.
And yeah, that makes sense.
It sort of feels kind of like classic Doctor Who, but still very modern. And I listened to the audio book, which is read by Nick Briggs, so it had sound, it had the Dalek voices, it had the TARDIS dematerialization and cloister bells and all the fun sounds. And Nick Briggs did a surprisingly good job bringing that sort of commanding, gravelly voice of John Hurt, which I can't do. I'm sorry. Sounds like Krusty the Clown is the War Doctor.
That's the audience.
For God's sake, Gallifrey stands. Which is a whole nother audio, but read this book.
Calvin?
Well, about a month ago, from the time of this recording, the Wizard World Comic Con was in Minneapolis, and I went to it and actually got to see Sylvester McCoy live.
Yeah. Oh, I would hope so.
Yeah. Yeah. No. Yeah. They just wheeled his freshly dead corpse onto the stage. No. He was alive. And this is the first time I've ever been to an event like this. I've been to conventions before, but never one of these celebrity Q&A oriented kind of ones. And Sylvester was a lot of fun. I mean, he is one of the most energetic people you can imagine. And a lot of times for like a Q&A panel, the guest just kind of sits there on stage and just answers questions. Sylvester actually runs out into the audience with holding the mic himself and like goes into the crowd and gets right up to him and asks some questions. It's kind of amazing how he is exactly like the Seventh Doctor, just in the normal way he comports himself. How do I put it? He's never stands still. He's running around. He rolls his R's to like the most absurd degree. Like someone asked him about playing Radagast the Brown in the Hobbit movies, and he's like, ah, yes, Radagast the Brown. You know, I mean, geez, he's actually like that.
Only actor to play the Doctor was told to tone it down.
Pull it back in. Well, he's such a theatrical sort of guy to begin with. He was wearing like a sport coat that had like stars and moons all over it, and a bowler. And
did he fall into a bowl of breakfast cereal on his way to the stage?
I would. That would have been great. You know, and he's such a short little guy that you just kind of saw this bowler hat kind of
bobbing around
while making
some... You make him sound like Cousin It.
That's not an inappropriate comparison in a weird way. But he was a lot of fun. I just want to say that.
Awesome.
For my temporal grace, I want to talk, or I just want to inform our listeners that we're going to be at Twin Cities Convention Convergence, probably at right about this time this episode is being broadcast. So if you're hearing us right now, come on down to Convergence. We're going to be doing a live recording of Get Off My World with returning guest Ariel Leaf. And I'm sure we'll have a lot of fun and surprises. So that is what I'm looking forward to in the world of Doctor Who right now.
Wow, that's narcissistic.
Totally. Absolutely.
Oh, kind of.
You're looking forward to yourself?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm looking forward to the next recording.
What else is there to look forward to in this recording?
Can I change my temporal grace to I'm looking forward to doing this show with you guys? That's the thing I'm most looking forward to in the world of Doctor Who, is doing this show.
I'm not actually looking forward to anything that's happening in Doctor Who. I'm just looking forward to my reactions to things that are happening in Doctor Who.
I look forward to disapproving about the latest episode of Doctor Who.
Anyway, now we're moving on to round two, Special Topics Dalek. And today's topic, the entire 50-year history of Doctor Who, as if it were one massive role-playing game. What were the critical successes and critical failures rolled?
Well, let me jump in here.
And such things, yes.
Oh, so this was my nonsense question when I originally came up with this, and it spun out of something that Tim Uren and I talked about for the first time years and years ago, which was we would have this little game where we would watch like a TV show or a movie, and we would ask, who's game mastering this movie? And by which we meant, what do we mean, Tim?
It's a sort of model of literary analysis that looks at movies, TVs, books, whatever, through the lens of role-playing game.
All right, so it's like, what type of story is this? Who are the players? What type of game master is doing it? And what kind of rules of the universe can we infer from the things that happen on screen? I know.
Instead of guessing which series of Doctor Who looked like they were directed by Hitchcock and which ones look like they were directed by Hal Needham, we're going to be, yes, which episodes of Doctor Who use World of Darkness mechanics and which episodes use Cinnabar or...
Of like, is there a scene where you can say someone lost sanity? Is there a scene where someone has made a critical success? Does this person...
I will admit the idea that the entire 50-year history is like one guy's role-playing game campaign where his players keep changing on him, so he has to constantly recast all the roles, yet somehow he insists on maintaining some kind of through line.
Whoever that player is playing the Doctor, that guy has got some serious pull with the Game Master.
Yeah, first of all, a Oh, no, are you kidding me? That's clearly the Game Master. I mean, that is clearly the Mary Sue character. That is the that is the Game Master's pet character, so, obviously.
So you think the Doctor is a non-player character run by the Game Master?
In the future, the Doctor becomes the Game Master, like Merlin, his future incarnation.
It's sort of like being a failure.
I'm going to suggest that he's obviously got some sort of GM immunity going on during the course. He's got immunity from the mechanics of the game. So
that's the interesting thing about Doctor Who specifically is his ability to spontaneously develop abilities.
When it's time to overcome this, he just happens to know how to fence.
Yeah, it's kind of like, well, in the old DC Heroes game, they had
here it comes.
They had something called the Omni Gadget, which was a gadget, and you literally didn't have to define what that gadget did until you used it. It was a way of explaining things like the old Green Arrow, like how Green Arrow happens to just have this weird ass arrow in his quiver.
It just happens to be the special purpose arrow that fixes whatever the problem
is. It was a way of shark repellent.
Bat shark repellent.
And it was like, so I suppose the Doctor would have like a, I guess it would be more of a psychic equivalent of an Omni gadget.
There's a skill that's been turning up in RPGs recently, which as an old grognard just absolutely infuriates me. It's a skill called preparedness. Roll to see if you have the thing you should have for this situation. And everyone, of course, just, loads that skill up and then blows off the whole idea of writing down what they have or thinking about what they should bring with them. And then they've just got this bag of holding filled with whatever needs to fill the plot right there. And that actually drives me out of my tree. Any career I do have is related to Call of Cthulhu, a game that is notorious for punishing players for not thinking, or not putting any thought into what they're about to do. You're going to try and mechanic your way out of player laziness.
So I'm getting a little ahead of ourselves because we're going to be talking about this in our next episode. Oh. But there's a skill in the Time Lord Doctor Who RPG called Resourceful Pockets. That is,
that's the fourth
that survived into the Cubicle 7
version. Oh, it's also in Cubicle 7. Okay. Yes. So this is functionally the same, I think, as your Omni Gadget that you're talking about, or the preparedness that you're talking about, Scott. And I can see how that sort of thing would drive traditional role players like us nuts. But is it maybe the kind of thing that you have to do if you're going to model what actually happens in the show?
I guess it's, not completely inappropriate for Doctor Who, considering that there's always a pocket inside that Tom Baker jacket that has something useful, even if it's not a jelly baby. Perhaps for this genre, it's not totally infuriating.
Let me pose a Doctor Who role-playing question here for you guys.
Pose it, Tim.
What does the Doctor do to gain experience points? What is it that rewards him as a character?
Well, that's clearly why he's the pet NPC of the Game Master. I don't see the Doctor as being gameable, which is one of my gripes with some of the actual games.
Well, my theory is that he gets experience by, or it, as an NPC, or whatever he is as a game phenomena, what he wants to do is take other people, companions, through adventures, that he gets better by advancing others.
Yeah, he doesn't kill orcs and take their gold.
No. He wants other people to kill orcs and take their gold.
And then complain to them about how they killed somebody.
Yes, that's horrible.
That's the follow-on to the whole killing part.
There should have been another way, but I'll take that gold.
Yes.
he's like some demigod that just shows up and gives you instructions.
Well, let's see, conceptualizing the whole, every season for the last 50 years as a role-playing game. I mean, clearly this is a role-playing game where the Game Master has lost control of the narrative. Has completely lost control of the narrative, which is now being controlled by the most charismatic person at the table. Possibly now their boyfriend or their girlfriend, let's be honest. Because I don't believe that you could have this amount of abusive plot by a character in a role-playing game unless there was sex involved behind the scenes.
I like the idea of Stephen Moffat as the Game Master's domineering significant other.
Then it becomes this roller coaster that the rest of the player characters are holding on to for dear life, hoping that they're not going to be killed outright and looking for a way, frankly, off the TARDIS with their and experience points and their levels, and they just like to get on with their lives now, please.
That would be the fifth Doctor module, I think.
Yeah.
So we think that some of the companions might be played by the same players who just got tired of, like, clearly, I think in the case of somebody like Dodo, who just, like, leaves off-screen and never comes back, and then all of a sudden there's Ben and Polly, like, oh, this player just got tired of this particular character.
Yeah.
And it rolled up a few new ones, and, let's go with these.
Not every character concept is a winner, and I've certainly seen people walk away from them mid-campaign where they realize, I'm terribly bored.
I was notorious in my D&D days for never having a character that advanced beyond fifth level because I would just get bored with them. It's like, I don't want to be a thief anymore. I want to be a fighter. Ah, no, a fighter's being born.
I want to be a bisexual 50th century time-traveling head of a conspiratorial institute.
Well, yeah, who wouldn't?
Yeah. Until fifth level, then you're bored.
Then I become a bard.
So you think the person who was playing Dodo just stopped? They bide their time for 40 years.
No, this is the guy who played Adam from The Long Game.
You're right.
Just like, I'm tired of that. I'm going to be Captain Jack from now on. That's
probably
my theory.
Good choice.
That's my headcanon.
And then there's also the question of what Game Master would decide. What this party needs to sort of help them along is a TARDIS, an infinitely powerful device.
There's always that moment where you, as the Game Master, invent something, hand it out to the players, and realize they're going to put it to uses you never thought of. You just thought it was going to be a handy way to move them from one scenario to the other, this TARDIS thing. Yeah. And, you know, you hand it over to them, and suddenly the players are using it to set off suns and, you know,
drag the Earth across
entire
the galaxy.
Star systems and, you know, steal the Mona Lisa and abduct Marilyn Monroe. And it's all out of control now. I can remember a few games in high school that were just like that.
That's great for the Game Masters. All you have to be prepared for is the players might go anywhere in time and space. So just be ready for that.
Yeah. So make sure you prep Ancient Rome and the present day and the far future. Oh, and everything else.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. The potential source book you would need for Doctor Who would be the size of a room.
The sandbox is very large.
Yeah,
which is why you need the Doctor as an NPC to be the thing that delivers the plot. And I realize there's such a thing as player-generated content, but you'll notice that in video games, player-generated content is essentially players killing each other over and over again. That's all player-generated content is breaking things and blowing things up.
They all have character names like Dickface Mega Boobs or something like that.
I heard that might be the Doctor's next traveling companion.
Dickface Mega Boobs?
Oh, I've seen pictures of that guy a lot. He's awesome. So the 50-year history of Doctor Who, to bring this to a close, we've decided it's a big railroad, isn't it? The Game Master indulging either his own personal peccadilloes or the tyranny of some individual player. And the poor bastards who are playing the companions are just on a railroad, stuck until the end of it.
I think it also implies some unsavory connection between the Doctor and his own narrative.
Yes, it does.
He can somehow warp the narrative texture to fit what he can do.
Yes.
That's actually been a thing in some of the novels. I think Lawrence Miles mentions that at some point, where he can warp probability so that, this jailer will let him out at this particular time. So that's really just like bribing the Game Master with another Mountain Dew or something, right?
That's why I still think that the Doctor and the Game Master are dating, because that kind of influence never happens unless you're going to hear about it at home after the game.
And now round three, the randomizer. Usually, we discuss a story selected completely at random, but for this episode, we've let one of our guests be the randomizer. Scott, what story did you pick for us to watch, and why?
I'm going to pick The Sea Devils, on the grounds that it was the very first Doctor Who episode that I ever saw. Back before you kids had this internet thing and everything was on DVDs, people like me had to catch our Doctor Who and our Monty Python where we could, and that meant PBS. That meant the same place that brought us Big Bird and the Electric Company was also the people who brought us our Monty Python and our any of our British television shows. So one of the things I remember as a kid was stumbling across the Doctor Who episode, The Sea Devils, without any idea of who Doctor Who was or what the show was about. And tuned into the scene where they're on the sea fort off the coast. So it's this sort of haunted house, abandoned structure, creepy, you know, stoneworks out by the ocean thing going on with some sort of slimy monster stalking this strangely overdressed man with, you know, frilly cuffs and the frilly front of his jacket and this, you know, woman. And that's where I was dropped into Doctor Who at that moment. Did not have any clue what was going on, but stuck it out and, you know, came back. And it was only, they'd only showed two episodes at a time. So I had to come back over the next 3 weeks to see how this thing turned out. And suddenly it went from slimy monsters to suddenly there's a sort of Fu Manchu stand-in with a goatee. And, there's the British Navy and submarines and horrible alien monsters, but they're not aliens. You know, at first I'm thinking I'm watching some sort of Creature from the Black Lagoon sort of thing, but then the Creature from the Black Lagoon has a ray gun, you know, which would have made things much more difficult there on the Amazon for, you know, John Agar if the creature had pulled out a damn ray gun and just sapped him, you know. But that was my first taste of Doctor Who, was Pertwee taking on the Sea Devils. And again, it was also awesome because not only did it have Pertwee, but it had Roger Delgado, who always will be the master for me.
Well, and I do think that is the best part of the Sea Devils, rewatching it, is all the stuff between the Doctor and the Master. My favorite part is just the Doctor's sheer joy at seeing him in prison. When he says, "I think he's put on weight," and laughs.
It's so queeny. Yeah. There is some disconnect between the love that the actors all seem to have for one another and the fact that this guy is a mass murderer who will, you know, exterminate all life on the planet if you let him out.
That's true, Pat. It's still damn enjoyable to watch, despite the body count.
Did anyone else, in retrospect, get kind of a weird, I don't know, Guantanamo Bay sort of feel about this place that they've got him locked up in, you know?
It does seem to be like a really weirdly special, outside the usual court system.
Yeah, the prison does seem like a pretty luxury setting for the Master.
He's watching it turns out to be the Clangers. I had to look it up. It's the Pigs in Space thing.
It was like a weird British kids cartoon. Yeah.
I'm so excited Scott chose this, not only for the sort of Deep Ones side mention.
There's definitely that Lovecraft connection.
I was a little surprised watching this again that they straight up state that they are relatives of the Silurians. From the get-go.
There's a lot of continuity. They even talk about the Brigadier blowing up the Silurians,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, I thought for sure that was like some kind of retcon thing.
Nope.
The thing that got me is when Pertwee, like the nerdiest nerd who ever nerded a nerd, has to complain about the name of the Silurians.
Yeah, right.
Where he's like, oh, like clearly whoever named them was an idiot because they're not from the Silurian
That was probably me who named him.
And that's also wrong, too. Whatever he actually says, I don't remember, is also incorrect, paleontologically speaking.
Eocenes, which is totally ridiculous.
They should have just called them the Cave Devils, and that would be fine.
Cave Devils, Sea Devils.
Wouldn't be having this argument.
Prairie Devils, Mountain Devils.
But given our overall theme, I was also watching this series in terms of a role-playing game. And whoever is playing Joe and the Doctor in this series were really good players. They were sharp. They made good decisions.
Yeah, they're really. I don't really remember anything that they did that came off as, and I have the plot resolution in my pocket, and they just pull it out. You know.
Yeah.
There was always a plan. They always improvised the materials available in ways that were believable to me, and also, you know, awesome sword fight. Let's not forget awesome sword fight.
Yep.
There's lots of machismo and posturing in the sword fight where the Doctor defeats the Master once and
gives
then
him a sword.
Gives him the sword back so they can fight again. But you're
My favorite was when he sat on the sword blade. You know, where he just jumps up and lands on the sword blade and pins it to the table and then picks up a sandwich. Cheese sandwich, just starts eating, and it's like, sandwich, oh yeah, these two, you can tell these two dildos spent some time on the British stage.
Sandwiches are a vital
part. You had to learn how to sword fight.
Rolled a natural 20, was able to sit on the sword blade and eat a sandwich before the next round happened.
Well, it's especially apparent in the Third Doctor era that it's clearly some weird British public school system schoolboy rivalry thing that, like, never died, and that's basically the Doctor and the Master. Like,
does he actually imply in that episode that they knew each other at school or something like that? Does he actually drop
that? I think that actually
he certainly says that he knew him before in the episode.
It pops up
he
here
says
and
they were
there.
Friends once, I think, in there. I don't know if he qualifies it as school or when. And, I mean, to me, again, this is where the show is a lot of fun, when it is more in the vein of the Time Monster or these kind of lighter family moments. I think it's disappointing as a sequel to the Silurians, particularly because you don't have the Brigadier or any of UNIT there. I think to actually replay these events with the Brigadier there and to see what the Brigadier's choice this second time around is, and there's not a lot of moral gray area. They make Walker come in, and he is just a ridiculous cartoon character, and they give the Doctor an easy out.
There's a nice character in Captain Hart, though, mm-hmm. who's played by Edwin Richfield, who's just all over television from this era. And in film, he's in Quatermass 2 and Quatermass in the Pit. He's in X the Unknown. I've seen him in Danger Man and the Avengers. He's also in The Twin Dilemma. So he's just a good, solid character actor mm-hmm. who stands in for the Brigadier, and he doesn't have the same sort of depth, but he has a kind of gravitas. And then he's played off against the guy who plays Walker, Martin Boddy, who is the worst side of that. It's the Malcolm Hulk version of upper class, disconnected to reality, nonsense people.
That was, again, part of what, analyzing this as a role-playing game, that Walker is an NPC who comes in late in the day, who is destructive and awful. But early in the day, you have an NPC that is really weird, like Blythe, that assistant, mm-hmm. who is paying attention and notices when, like, they've been missing for a little while, they didn't bring their boat back. We should look into that. Like, no NPC in a gaming adventure would do that, of like...
But speaking of the boat back, I would like to point out that obviously you should never rent anything you own to the Doctor or to Joe Grant, because that poor bastard who's like, you know, hey, here's a boat. I got 20 quid to rent my boat. That boat never comes back. Here's 20 quid for the motorcycle. You better hope that motorcycle didn't cost less than 20 quid, because you're never seeing it again. It's... You know, Joe Grant drives it off, and it's gone,
I mean, you're talking about a guy who just flat-out steals his outfits from random people who are around when he regenerates.
He did give the car back.
In he did give the car the back.
Only because the Brigadier made him.
And also, I you guys have praised Joe Grant in the past, and I'm not as hip to the Joe Grant world, but I was...
You're a Joe Grant hater.
No, I was flabbergasted to see a companion looking through a window saying, this is my plan, this is what I'm going to do, and the Doctor says, cool.
Oh, he's...
With no addendum.
Yes.
No corrections. He's just like, okay, go make so that good. Happen.
No, he's really hot and cold on Joe in this episode, because there's that. There's also that moment where she says, I totally saw the Master walking around, you know, dressed like an admiral or whatever it was. And he's like, yes, I believe you. You're my companion, and I totally believe you. Which, under other circumstances, you would expect, like, oh, you girls, nonsense. You're just blah, blah, blah. And then later she squirms through the ventilation vents because she has a low size score and she's the only one who can do it. So those are the real positive things about the Joe interaction in this adventure. But then there's the like, super dick move where he steals her sandwich. Do you remember that?
Oh, I do.
Like, that's a comedy scene. It was gold.
It's a comedy,
I laughed my
It's a comedy scene, but it's actually...
It's funny, except she doesn't get a sandwich.
She doesn't get a sandwich. This is...
It's not like a belittling her. He ate her sandwich.
Yes.
This is the only way he's able to get any power over her in all of this episode. It's with the pathetic move of taking her sandwich, which, if he thinks that evens the score, okay then, but it doesn't.
Okay. That's the whole point of the doc. Doctor, temporal sandwich theft.
As a comedy enthusiast, I have to say that John Pertwee's performance in that scene is hilarious. It's very Leslie Nielsen. It's like something out of like Naked Gun. He's just so deadpan and nodding. He's so intent and listening, and just more sandwich goes in his face. More and more. And Joe is so crestfallen. There's just this tiny like, oh, it's my sandwich.
It breaks her tiny little heart, though.
You don't see the doctor eating that much.
Except well, for when he wants to get power over Joe.
Yeah, yeah.
And the master. It's like...
Steals the master sandwich, too, again.
But it's the subterranean theme of the Sea Devils. Sandwich theft.
Yeah, clearly, this was important. They would not have put this in here if they didn't want us to be arguing about it 30 years later.
It was totally a theme, because even Walker says... murder? War always is, my dear. Now, where's that girl with my toast?
You're right, it is. It's like
he displayed his evil through his desire for sandwiches.
Yeah, doesn't right. they zoom in on his mouth? It's just close up of him, like,
yeah,
chewing.
He smacks his
crumbs
lips,
are falling
you know,
out of his mouth.
It's like, he's a sensualist. He needs a toast. But, you know, the doctor just, he does what he does. It's necessary to steal.
I must eat these sandwiches.
Do you think that this road of argument is fruitful? Should we continue it for a little bit longer?
I would like to return to the idea that the about the Brigadier not being there, it may have limited some of the options for callbacks to Silurians. However, by having the Brigadier not there, it did mean we got to have hovercraft and giant 40-millimeter Bofors cannons firing, because none of that would have been possible except that the Royal Navy was all in.
Yeah, I am entirely on board for gratuitous use of hovercrafts. and as you mentioned earlier, Creature from the Black Lagoon with a ray gun.
And the submersible they dropped the doctor down in.
With those weird wetsuits that look like Zygons.
Although... because of the Royal Navy, it's weird with the theme of anti-violence, and it's a sequel to the Silurians to a certain extent, that they have the glorified full episode that is just this sort of fetishizing the Navy, mowing down the Sea Devils in all sorts of new and terrifying ways. The Sea Devils are just getting mowed down left and right.
Oh, the minefield.
It's a fun sequence.
There's a minefield scene that just kind of happens.
With the barbed wire.
I love the mine.
Yes.
And the minefield reminds me of the other, the Malcolm Clark soundtrack, particularly this.
Oh, yeah.
There is a particular sting, it made me think of Kelvin, in the minefield moment that sounds just like electronic flatulence.
That
it's just this sort of like, it
so
shows the minefield, it zooms in and it goes, which I think would be a great warning for minefields.
It's interesting that, you know, the Silurians had the very avant-garde soundtrack that was not terribly successful, shall we say.
I think parts of it are
well, parts of
really
it were,
eerie.
But the Sea Devils also has a very avant-garde soundtrack, but I really liked it. Early 70s goofing around with synth stuff. I don't know. It's just one of my things, I guess.
We could probably talk the whole episode about the Sea Devils, but you guys, we don't have time. There's not enough time. We got to wrap up. I know. So,
I will say this, though. It is that moment you return to it. I haven't seen it in 30 years. So going back to it, there were things that stood out as a kid that I remembered with crystal clarity, and they were like when the hovercraft rolls up on the beach and when the big fight at the end and the creeping around inside the sea fort. Those are things that really stood out for me. But what I had not remembered was the fact that the Sea Devil's heads start at the top of the stunt actor's head.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So they're looking out the neck somewhere. They had these really astounding sort of, I don't know, sea turtle neck style heads. That was another thing I liked, is that their heads look like sea turtles. They went with a different kind of marine reptile. And there's one other thing I wanted to drop in here is Jabba the Hutt is in this episode.
Yes, he is. He's the guy on the rig at the beginning.
The guy goes nuts?
Yeah.
Declan Mulholland, the heavyset guy who survives the Sea Devils coming on board the Sea Fort, is the guy who played the original Jabba the Hutt in the very first...
The ambulatory Jabba the Hutt.
Yeah, who's not in the final
film. For the first Star Wars film.
Oh, man.
He's also the guy who guns down a plesiosaur with Doug McClure in The Land of Time Forgot.
Nice.
Which I hold out as awesome because it's the first time I ever saw somebody firing one of those weird old Bergman machine guns from World War II.
Yeah.
And again, gunning down a plesiosaur is always awesome, no matter what. So that's, call out to Declan Mulholland, who sadly is no longer with us.
So, guys, what's our final verdict on the Sea Devils?
We love the Sea Devils.
Okay, I have one of my little...
Oh, here it comes. Here it comes.
Slightly prevaricating left-handed compliments.
Let's hear it.
But if I had to pick a six-episode Doctor Who story to show a preschooler, I would pick the Sea Devils.
Don't you think it'd be sad when they get mowed down by the Navy and they're falling off buildings?
No, I bet they'd be into it.
You're right. It depends on it depends the neighborhood of the preschool, maybe.
Yeah. They'd be like, yay!
If I can disconnect it from the Silurians, which I think is a far superior piece of television, this is fun in so many respects. Yeah, a little bit of a disappointing sequel.
It's very center of the strike zone Third Doctor story.
The sandwich thematics do elevate it,
though. Dear listeners, for the next Wonderful Afunctionalism segment, Scott Glancy interviews tabletop RPG legend Ray Wininger about Ray's early work for FASS's Doctor Who RPG. However, that interview runs 55 minutes long, and we're not going to just drop it right here in the middle of this episode of Get Off My World. Instead, we're going to release it as its own special episode sometime in the next couple of weeks, so watch for that. In the meantime, here's a brief teaser from the interview.
Tell me how it was that you initially approached FASA.
Sure.
And got to work. Working on their role playing.
Sure. So I grew up in Chicago. FASA was headquartered in Chicago. So that meant that I kind of knew a lot of people in and around FASA. You know, you used to go to the local game conventions and so forth, and I would see them and meet them and game with them. And
were they the subject of discussion around the game stores and things? Like, you know, because they were the hometown boys or...
Yeah, in some game stores, for sure. You know, the gaming, you know, this is way, way pre-internet, of course. So gaming was a much more, the game communities are much, much more regional then. You know, you knew the people in your area and you'd see them and whatnot. So I was quite aware of them and had played games with them and such and had, you know, new people there. And while I was still in high school, I was quite a fan of the Doctor Who show, and FASA got the license for Doctor Who. I read that they'd got the license and were publishing the RPG, and I thought that, okay, it's finally time for me to take a stab at writing my own RPG material. I'd been playing the games for a long time. So I reached out to people I knew there and said, I'm interested in writing this. I'm pleased to say that despite the fact that I was, I think I was 17 years old at the time, no one thought that was that unusual or treated me
anymore. Or a bar. Like, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. No one said, sorry.
Come back when you can vote, kid.
That never happened. Instead, the reaction was, well, send us a... write up a proposal for what you want to do and send that to us. And I did that. And the first proposal I wrote, they thought, this sounds great. Go ahead, go to it. And I wrote the book, and that's what kicked me off down that path.
Because you were working with a property and because FASA was working with a property that was owned by somebody else, what were you aware of any oversight that the BBC was interested in having over the project?
I was never made aware of anything like that, and in retrospect and you know, years later, and having talked to those the folks at FASA about this years later, there was shockingly little, in fact. You know, I think that's mostly attributable to the fact that back in those days, the idea of licensing a role-playing game was a very, very new thing. FASA, prior to Doctor Who, did a game based on Star Trek, and that was really the first big licensed RPG, the first time somebody had really licensed a big property. And it was just kind of a new thing, and I think the licensors didn't really know how to deal with it. You didn't have the whole kind of culture and the whole approach to quote-unquote intellectual property like you have today, where you create something like Doctor Who, and there's a whole department at the BBC that we're going to do novels, and we're going to do comic books, and we're going to do this, and we're going to do that, and here's how we're going to oversee it. It was all, I think it was all just kind of, you know, just done on the fly and you know, done very sort of seat of the pants.
And now round five, my emotional journey through time and space. This is a round I just made up. When I was getting prepared to be part of this podcast, I felt like I needed to revisit a Doctor Who episode, so I rewatched some old Doctor Who, and I started watching new Doctor Who starting from Rose moving forward. And I had a strange sort of experience. Rose, I watched much like anybody watches Rose. You appreciate it for its accomplishment. You criticize it for the things that are worth criticizing. But then I watched The End of the World, which was when Christopher Eccleston's Doctor takes Rose to witness the end of the Earth. And when I first watched this, I just sort of took it as, let's go on a weird space adventure to some exotic space location. But watching it this time with the knowledge of the subsequent 7 seasons of Doctor Who that takes them through getting Gallifrey back and all of that, it struck me that there was some deeper emotional stuff going on here that I had not picked up on the first time. Hmm. And that led me to watching the rest of the series with this sort of attention. So let me talk about The End of the World. So Christopher Eccleston. Yeah.
Even yeah. Christopher Eccleston.
The Ninth Doctor.
Yes. Much better.
The first place he chose to take Rose was to watch her planet get destroyed.
Yes.
So this is my theory on proceeding forward, that he was trying to communicate how he felt having just lost his planet. Right?
Yeah.
That makes some sense.
I'm with you so far.
So that he, in a way that he's never had to communicate with a companion before, he had to really open up about what he was feeling. So he takes it, and then some story happens, and there's this flap of skin that's stretched.
He walks through a fan.
Yes.
Yeah, whatever.
And so it encouraged me to move forward watching the series, paying attention to the sort of submerged emotional content, and to let go a lot of the little annoying things that are annoying about the new series. So after he shows her the end of her planet, he takes her back in time in The Unquiet Dead to show her ghosts. And I'm working on the assumption that any time he travels through space and time, he's doing it very deliberately for a very deliberate purpose, which is not explicit in the narrative. Everyone's nodding at me sort of suspiciously, but...
No, I
think that's a fair description.
And so they encounter ghosts, which is a sort of metaphor for what the Doctor is at that point. Even though he has survived this terrible thing, he is the walking wounded. And, as we found out later, that the metaphor of these are these ghosts that want to find a conduit to come back into this world parallels Gallifrey's current state. Like, they want a way back in, but it's important they don't. And I moved on to the Aliens of London, where at the very top, Rose and the Doctor comes back. It's been a year. It seems like this is going to be an episode about tremendous consequence of, like, oh my goodness, they've been gone a year. He has to pay the price. But then flatulent aliens invade, and that all goes away, and it's kind of... lost for a little bit.
It's a false resolution.
That narrative stumbles.
Like flatulence.
Nothing
you
but
think
gas.
It's like, oh,
this is
going to
be something big and important, and it's
so,
not.
There's going to be a fart and a windstorm metaphor at any minute.
And then World War III happens. Dalek.
And then World War III happens.
We'll skip that for now. And he is confronted with this terrible past that he is trying, that has wounded him so badly. Father's Day. No other doctor, I think, would have the idiocy to try to take a companion back in time twice. And it is only because of this doctor's sympathy for this dilemma of having lost someone you love that he would do something so stupid as to bring Rose back twice. Then, are you with me still?
I'm following, Tim.
All right. So then he makes a trip that is not his own plan. He's following this little capsule thing that we learn later Captain Jack arranged. We get to the Empty Child. He's back in World War II, a place he would never go on his own because he hates war at this point. Empty Child, Dr. Dance's big, big resolution. It's this emotional moment for him, transformative. He forms a real family bond with Rose and Captain Jack. So then we get back to Boomtown. They have this moment of togetherness that when I watched it the first time, it was really annoying because it's that that we're mates in a pub sort of thing. Mm-hmm. But now that I'm watching it with this more open mind, like, oh, they formed a family, a real unit together, and it's a good thing for the Ninth Doctor. And then he dies.
And there's Bad Wolf in the Part Anyways, where that family unit just falls completely apart. And I think the Ninth Doctor's regeneration scene was lovely. I think one of the most successful regenerations of the new series. But so I kept going.
This may prove to be a mistake, because
it ultimately just does, but not yet.
I am finding this rather fascinating, actually.
So then it's David Tennant, Tenth Doctor, New Earth. Well, there's the Christmas invasion thing, which foreshadows what I discovered. New Earth. Same thing. I don't want to take you to where the world ends. I want to take you to where there's a new Earth.
A new Earth.
Yes. I'm a new doctor. It's a whole new thing, except for it's rotten at its core. There's something really, really wrong. And
the
I don't.
Script.
Yes. Yeah. Well, that's the thing. I don't know if this is purposeful. Purposeful.
Purposeful. The Knight of the Round Table.
It's a good Wagner opera.
Yeah.
But the point is, it's there. That new Earth is really, really rotten. There's something bad at its core, and there's something bad at the core of this dysfunctional relationship between the new Doctor and Rose that really messed Rose up. I mean, really, Rose as a character from that point on is ruined. She's just lost.
Just wrecked.
Just wrecked. I mean, that's what she said in Christmas Invasion. Is, how could you do this to me? Really? I died saving your life? I'm sorry. yes, and so New Earth concludes with, we're going to spray Kool-Aid all over models, and we'll be happy about
everything.
That. Yes. Then it's Tooth and Claw.
Tooth and Claw. Brotherhood of the Wolf.
So in the same way that the Ninth Doctor sort of revealed himself to be the metaphor of a ghost, the Tenth Doctor, and here's where you're going to like this, revealed himself to be the metaphor of a werewolf.
What?
He is a very divided character. And in fact, even as I was watching it thinking, I'm totally kidding myself. I'm living a lie. And then they have this shot of where the Doctor is listening at a wall, and you can see half his face, and you see half the face of the wolf on the other side of the wall, making one face of the two figures. And you always wonder, like, why does the Tenth Doctor act like this freakish, sort of violent, antagonistic, like, he has these fits.
He's mercurial.
It's because he is in denial of his alien self. He denies that part of him is a Time Lord.
He wants to be human?
He desperately wants to be human. He shows that over and over again. And a Tooth and Claw, like, he and Rose are trying so hard to have this we're fun relationship, we're wacky fun, and like Queen Victoria's there, like two people just gave their lives so you had the precious seconds to make your funny remarks just now. And then that Rose relationship devolves. They go to school reunion. There's Sarah Jane, and Rose learns, like, oh, I'm not special. Girl in the fireplace, and there's another lady there, and Rose says, I'm not special. Are you going to kick me out here soon?
No,
this is great.
Never seen where you're really going with this. You're doing all the work.
And then there's the Cybermen, Rise of Cybermen, the Age of Steel, where Rose, her desire is so strong, in fact, to get out of this, that she summons her dead father back from the dead in another universe, like we're just jumping the whole dimensional barrier to go somewhere else.
Is that your phrase for jumping the shark is
I will not deny that.
Please continue.
And there's Idiot's Lantern, and that goes without discussion.
Yeah, gloss over it really quickly.
Yeah, there's a lot of that. And then the Impossible Planet, and Satan's Pit, that's fun. And Love and Monsters.
Are we going all the way through to Capaldi?
We're going to stop short of Capaldi.
That's not encouraging. We're short.
But the pace is picking up here. So in Doomsday, I think it is, they mirror that same shot of Doctor and the Werewolf with the Doctor and Rose.
Oh. Yeah.
When she's on the other side and she's no longer, like, she can't be reached anymore, so they have the two faces. So the Doctor is starting to move on. He's been at least physically separated from this dysfunctional relationship. Moving on. Runaway Bride. Donna is so perfect a partner for the Doctor. The TARDIS literally reaches out and grabs her out of time and space and pulls her in there. And they have this adventure. And at the end of it, Donna says, you are not a good person to be with. She rejects him because he has this still weird, violent outbreak sort of tendency. So he needs something else. And this is the big discovery I made on this. And I'm sure we're at like an hour by now. Martha Jones was so much more interesting
than I ever thought she was. Because I always took her for, as many people I think do, as to be, you know, that companion who's not Rose. Like, oh, I wish I was Rose. Oh, our relationship is I wish I was Rose. But that's not who she is. She's the doctor's doctor. She is the one who's supposed to get him ready for his true companion, which is Donna. So they have Smith and Jones, where they meet. There's a Shakespeare code where there's the metaphor of witches, which doesn't fit as neatly into my little model, but it does demonstrate the importance of talking and the importance of words. Gridlock. This is one that's important.
Yes.
It's got the macra.
It's got the macra.
Cat people.
Cat people. But most importantly, when it's all over and they're walking back to the TARDIS, Martha stops the doctor and makes him sit down and tell her what his experience was. Like, who are you? Why are you so upset? They have a brief little therapy session. Docs of Manhattan, Evolution, Daleks, and Lizards.
Best summation of Daleks in Manhattan ever.
Wow.
It is worth stopping to note that Evolution of the Daleks does at least touch on the theme of growing and changing and evolving. 42, I think, is an excellent episode, not often spoken of well.
Yeah.
Then Human Nature and Family of Blood really demonstrates how badly the Doctor wants to be a human. To the point that he would become a human.
Yes.
But he also has this sort of doctor watching him and guiding him through this therapy. Okay. Okay, then Sound of Drums and The Last of the Time Lords. Last of the Time Lords has a few problems. And those problems, the scale of those few problems is quite large.
Yes.
But at the end of the whole thing, the Doctor, who has been separated from his Time Lord self, is there with the Master, and he has been trying so hard to say, I forgive you. And he's not saying just, I forgive you to the Master. He's saying, I forgive you to all Time Lords who he's been separated from and who had forced him into this terrible situation, and also to his own Time Lord self. And then I'll,
You're not going to go back. You can't go back.
No.
You can't retrograde to an episode you forgot to mention. That's not...
So,
I forgot about an unearthly child.
So then, Voyage of the Damned, and this is cool, because Voyage of the Damned is like, everybody is like, the theme is being yourself. It's important to be yourself. And when, this is the first time that I noticed, the Doctor introduces himself to someone, I'm the Doctor, Time Lord from Gallifrey. He totally owns
it. Accepting it now.
Yes. And in that, then he moves on to Partners in Crime, where he meets Donna. And after the first moment, when there's like sucked completely into the TARDIS, now it's a real struggle to actually catch up to Donna. There's been comment before that it's sort of annoying with his relationship with Donna. They are always referring to them as a couple, but the fact is they are very good partners. And I'll pick up the pace here a little bit to the end. All right. But in some ways that was his arc. He was trying to meet with Donna, be a partner with her, and not have this dysfunctional relationship with Rose. The Next Doctor is a good episode, and The Planet of the Dead, I remember you discussing for its many, many sins, but I will at least give it this. It shows an example of the Doctor rejecting an unworthy companion.
Okay, yes.
It is reversed. He is not being rejected himself for being unworthy. He's rejecting someone else who is unworthy.
That does happen.
His long, protracted regeneration, which has been discussed, and then... The whole sort of model changes with Matt Smith. Again, as has been discussed, he's very Peter Pan-like, and in fact, the crack in the wall is very crocodile mouth-esque, threatening to swallow, to remove him from reality. So when Matt Smith's Doctor, the great thing to fear is being forgotten. That is always the threat, that he's going to be absorbed and forgotten. And the great... discovery at the end is that Amelia has remembered him, therefore he's redeemed from obscurity. Yay for Doctor Who fan Amelia. But then it reverses where he is too well known and he must then strive to let the universe know him less. I'm picking up the pace here.
Keep going.
And then strangely, so I've been watching it like I'm in this weird mindset and I'm trying to follow this track, and then you get to the end of Wedding and River Song, you get to move on to Asylum of Daleks, Doctor Who, and that story, that level of storytelling just goes dead. Like, there's radio silence, like there is no emotional subtext going on at all for the rest of Matt Smith for that season.
An emotional journey that just hit a brick wall.
Yes, and then you come back to Peter Capaldi, who has lots of interesting stuff going on that I will save for some other
moment. For a future guest appearance. So nothing can be added to what Tim has just said.
Nor should it be.
But it's impressive. Nothing can be taken away from it either.
It's impressive.
As in, there's no takeaway.
The only things that I would say is that if what you had just said were in a role-playing game campaign, it would be brilliant stuff that was happening in the head of the player that was never communicated to the GM.
Yeah,
that's how it feels.
And, of course, if it was in a novel, it would all be subtext. But as we know, Doctor Who fans don't do subtext.
Here's the extra bit, because I figure we have some more time to film.
Oh, it's got an extra bit. Excellent.
The subtext that was going on that has not yet blossomed. So the Ninth Doctor, and I am going back a little bit, in his moment of transformation, he is transformed when the unearthly child recognizes its mother, right?
What?
Later on, when the Master is trying to bring Gallifrey back, part of it is saved by his mother. When we get to Listen in Peter Capaldi, we again go to revisit the Doctor's family and his upbringing as a farm boy, apparently.
Yeah.
I'm totally getting that there is a low-level signal of the Doctor's family being a building theme going on. I've silenced the room.
That may be an accidental epiphenomenal sort of thing that's happening. I don't know.
I'm going to go with the theory that Tim has looked at a rock, seen a human face, and presumed it was carved by God. The cloud does not look like Godzilla because somebody wanted the cloud to look like Godzilla, unless, of course, you're talking about the Observer. This is the Observer effect in action. You are completely imposing meaning on a shapeless morass.
I am not ashamed to impose meaning on shapeless morasses.
That's literary criticism.
That
would be the basis of all literary criticism, is imposing your meaning.
I am explaining my subjective experience of watching several seasons of a very up and down show.
All right, Scott, then to wrap this up, can you give us what your shape would be if you had to put a shape on this morass?
That's a terrible thing to ask somebody.
And you have 30 seconds.
In 30 seconds.
Your
30-second
rebuttal.
My 30-second rebuttal is that any time that you have a massive narrative like this or a huge shared world, that it is impossible to have a central theme that goes through it, because every writer who picks up the script thinks they know better than the guy before them. The only time this ever works is when you got a single creator sitting on top of the property like a tyrant, and you will get their vision all the way through, even if it's a crap vision. When I have tried to do this in the past with things that were created the same way by writer of the week, I have gone down this route of madness that Tim is on. torturing myself, trying to create continuity where there clearly is none. And all I can say is, fuck you, Chris Carter, because my experience was the X-Files with this. And there was no plan, there was no overarching theme. When you got Whedon doing it for multiple seasons of Buffy, you know, we get this idea that this is the way all large stories work, that they're going to have continuity from beginning to end. And that's an illusion. That almost never, ever happens.
You make it up as you go.
Tim, you are going down the rabbit hole on this one.
I do not deny that.
This is going to end with a big wall full of little things cut out with string tied between the different articles connecting the Sea Devils with the Robots of Death, which is connected to the Doctor Dances. And you'll be able to map that all out, you know, but no one's going to want to make eye contact with
me. That's our podcast. Thank you, Tony, for recording all this. Oh, my God. Also, thank you, Tim. Thank you, Scott. But we're not done. Because both Scott and Tim will be back next episode for part two of this discussion about Doctor Who and role-playing games. We're going to be discussing Tim's Doctor Who story of choice, Robots of Death, and throwing 30 years of Doctor Who role-playing games into the death zone to see which is the ultimate Doctor Who RPG. And until then, I'm Pat.
I'm Joshua.
And I'm Kelvin.
And we're saying,
get off my world!
And now round three, the randomizer.
I got a randomizer.
Oh, I'm so excited we got a randomizer.
just five hobos talking about some random thing.
Fortunately, I have a randomizer in my pocket here so we can escape from the medieval jail cell.
All right, let me try this again.